the races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, 10 minutes into hour two. Nice, leisurely and long visit with Jack Sisterson, and obviously a lot to talk about with Jack, including Vexatious's victory and his first grade one. Rich Migliori standing by, and if you hear any noise in the background, tire jacks or cars on lifts, Richie getting the car service. So, Richie, good morning.
Good morning. I've walked away from the place, but you still might hear some noise. But that would be great. Great Whitney Day. Great week of racing up in Saratoga. Very happy for Jack Sisterson, somebody that all you hear is good things about, and that's unusual in any industry, but particularly ours.
Well, and he's doing it kind of the old fashioned way, you know, kind of earning attention from owners, and specifically Brad Kelly and the Calumet team, and you know, he's getting more chances, and he's obviously exceedingly capable, and working under Doug O'Neill for a period, and has a great approach, it seems, and he gets horses to develop. I mean, you can see them advance, and you know, this is a mare that you know we had talked about quite a bit during her ascent when Neil Drysdale had her, and you know, she's versatile, she's a hard hitter, and Rich, let's talk about specifically first the personal ensign, and there's a subplot to this where people, you know, minutes after they crossed the wire, not even minutes, they were jumping all over Ricardo Santana Jr. Oh, Mike Smith never would have let that happen. I'm sorry, that's not how this works. Ridiculous.
See, that's silly. Anybody saying that, they just either don't know how to watch a race, or they're just, that's just not rooted in reality. He gave the horse every chance. He gave Midnight Bizou every opportunity to win. That's all you can ask of a rider, to put them in a position to win from. And he worked out a beautiful trip into the first turn. He's on the big favorite, the champion. He's got an X on his back, and by the time he gets to the backstretch, he's in perfect striking position without being inhibited, not being trapped or in trouble. And she got outrun. I mean, she ran great. There was no, you know, embarrassment in the way she lost. Vexatious ran. Got to her, and it was a great stretch duel. Some good race riding on Jose Lascano's part. You know, I think he contributed to the win with his ride. Very savvy, came out. You know, in New York, people got to understand, too, in other jurisdictions, that might be a foul coming out to a horse like that, but not in New York. And if you ride in New York on a consistent basis, or you watch races in New York on a consistent basis, you know that's within the parameters of how the rules are interpreted in New York. And he rode right to that line. And the two mares ran. I mean, you have to applaud both of them. You know, the champion in defeat, her second start off of, you know, coming back from Saudi Arabia. She won eased up last time. Maybe she didn't get, you know, as much out of it from a fitness standpoint because she won in a common canter. But she stepped up. Her race was good. I mean, you are privy more to the buyer figures than I am at this point. What kind of buyer figures did they get?
They got 105s, and it's a career best for both of them. And frankly, you know, the figure watchers and people who use figures, that was and has been the watchword when it comes to wondering if Midnight Bizou is vulnerable in any spot, because she's run consistently, she's run very solidly, but she's never particularly been, you know, dominating from a fig standpoint, and that not that it's a vulnerability, but you know, when you're looking at all the methods of evaluation, that's certainly one area, and it's the area that tells you, you know, she is beatable. I personally didn't try to beat her, and I singled her in multis just on the basis of didn't seem like there was conditions that were going to, you know, add to her any vulnerability that you might perceive she had. And, you know, I could tell mid-stretch that she was in deep water and it was going to be hard to get by Vexatious.
Yeah, no doubt. But anybody who wants to, you know, heap blame on Ricardo Santana or even make the statement that it wouldn't have, you know, Mike Smith would have won on her, I just don't think they're really looking at it correctly. You know, I think emotion gets in the way sometimes, particularly when you have a champion, a filly or a mare now, who has, you know, created a fan base. And a lot of that, I give a lot of credit to Jeff Bloom and the racing partnership that owns her, everybody that has a stake in her, because they could have easily cashed in last fall. Instead, you know, campaigner as a five-year-old, and I like the trend. I mean, she was beaten by a six-year-old mare. I like the trend of horses returning at five, at six, Tom's d'etat, seven. I think, you know, one of the things that we got away from in our industry was these horses competing into their later years because of, and I understand it, you know, because of breeding and how lucrative that end of it is. But as a kid growing up, watching horses like Forgo return year after year, it gave you an opportunity to latch onto a horse and become a real fan of that horse. I used to get so excited waiting, you know, in May. I knew he was going to make his, you know, five-year-old debut, his six-year-old debut, his seven-year-old debut. So I applaud them for the sportsmanship, the sporting gesture of bringing these horses back at a fully mature age. Five is when a horse fully matures. And Vexatious stepped her game up, reached another level, and she forced Midnight Bisou, apparently, to another level. And I thought they put on a really good display, a great horse race. That's, as a fan, that's all you want is horses to go out there and give 100% and kind of get our heart rate up a little bit. But Ricardo Santana gave her a perfect trip, and she got outrun.
I agree. And it also sets up, you know, nice matchups down, you know, the road, and when we get to Breeders' Cup, and actually that was a storyline that was repeated throughout the day, and particularly later when we got to, you know, the counterpart and the Whitney, and here the, you know, the vulnerability was a little different, and here's Improbable Rich kind of antsy in the gate, as he is wont to do, and yet when they sprung the latch, he was gathered up and broke beautifully with Ortiz. Meanwhile, here was Joelle and Tom's d'Etat having that second jump kind of stumble where the knees kind of were down and head and shoulders go down, recovered quickly, but I'm curious your thoughts of what transpired from that point on, because they weren't going real fast, and it sure felt like if Joelle needed to or wanted to, he could have eased Tom's d'Etat closer into contention. He didn't have to rush him up at all. Some thoughts about what transpired there, particularly in the front half of the race.
Well, I mean, you know, this stumble was significant enough. It did cost him, you know, lengths. It did, you know, he was compromised by it for sure. You know, you think about Joel's style, and, you know, it's been working so well for him. He just allows horses to run into his hands and place themselves. And once he stumbled like that, and you know, from a former rider's perspective, sometimes a horse stumbles like that, and they're having a hard time sorting themselves out, finding their rhythm. And then you even question, well, I hope he didn't hurt himself. So you're kind of feeling him out in that respect. But then going back to Joel's style is to let horses, you know, fall into his hands. He's got such soft, supple hands. Horses kind of really respond to that. And it's been working so well for him that I think after that stumble, he probably just said, well, this is the hand I'm dealt. I'm going to let him gallop into my hands and see if we can finish. And And again, I can't read his mind. I just know from former experience that, you know, I've had horses stumble and had funny signs stumble with me. I think it was in the Woodward. And then he was getting out in the first turn, and he felt sound, but, you know, why is he getting out so bad? And did that stumble make something happen? And, you know, you got to look after the horse as well. I mean, I know a jockey's job is to get the best placing possible, but sometimes if you have a question, especially, you know, with horses that are such high-profile horses, you'll tend to go, you know, let me make sure this guy's okay. And now you've gone a little further, and the pace is soft, and, you know, basically the die is cast. So, you know, Tom's Detat didn't lose anything in defeat to me. It was unfortunate. But let's give Improbable his due. I mean, he ran. He really ran. And the fact that he left the gate on his feet so well, because he was not standing particularly well after he blew up. I was looking at his feet going, I was thinking he could stumble because he just wasn't 100% square. And, you know, his athleticism just allowed him to overcome that. He broke solidly. I had spoken with Irad Ortiz earlier in the week, and he was clear. He was going to be aggressive, and he was, and got forward position. And how many times do we say it? That wins races, being aggressive and getting your position going forward.
As we hear you talk you know, very frequently about that part of it, and it pays off because the trip was ideal, and Mr. Buff, you know, setting a pace that, if watching it and watching the replay, I mean, it kind of felt like they, Irad and Improbable could, you know, could take him at any time, and that's kind of the way it played out. And frankly, Rich, when they came off the turn, you could see the code of honor, you know, who hasn't really been dissected yet, his effort. He really never at any point looked like a threat.
No, but maybe that was a function of the pace. You know, I mean, he's a horse that I'm a big fan of. I thought he was coming into this race really well, watching him work. But he, he's definitely pace dependent. He's a horse that needs him to go quick, and, you know, then it'll keep coming. But again, I don't want to diminish anything Improbable did. I thought he was just very, very good on the day.
Well, agreed. And I mentioned earlier too that, you know, after Irad gave the assembled media a couple of minutes and a couple of questions, and he went to go get ready to ride the Jerkins, and I couldn't resist saying to him, makes up for the Derby last year as the beaten favorite in the Kentucky Derby, and it took him a second. He said, yeah. He said, yeah, absolutely.
he even made the comment after the race, though, that he had grown up immensely. Like, he was a completely different horse, much more mature. And again, the trend, seeing these horses return now, he's a four-year-old, to their later years. And I mean, I love it. I love the fact that Midnight Bijou's back, Tom's Detat's a story. You know, I made the analogy that reminds me of Jim Morris, that movie The Rookie. You know, he guy starts pitching in the major leagues at 36. He didn't, you know, he had one nagging thing, little thing kept stopping him, and finally to fulfill his potential or realize his potential. And then the resurgence of Calumet Farm. You know, I mean, you know, growing up as a kid, Calumet Farm is such a, you know, revered, historic, you know, stable, and the fact that Brad Kelly has Calumet Farm back on the map. And I mean, nothing against his colors. It's just, I grew up looking at that, you know, devil red and blue. I just wish that those were the colors still, but it thrills me that Calumet Farm is, you know, back on the map, making such a mark.
No, a big part. They had a huge weekend, obviously, as well, with Lexitone in second, the Bing Crosby. We just talked to Jack, and then Rusty yesterday wins at Kentucky Downs in the ladies' turf preview, English Affair, at a nice price. And so a very heady weekend for an Everfast as well in that allowance race. Let's stay on the jock evaluation recap mode, Rich, because the situation in the Bowling Green, again, you know, you mentioned, you know, the potential for the stewards to act when it came to the personal ensign. It was funny. I was over by Bill Mott and Lee Einsiedler that were watching near the racing office, and Lee asked Bill Mott about, you know, the Midnight Bisou Vexatious coming together, and Bill said, "If I didn't get put up, she's not getting put up."
That's what with, was, right. With a late. I mean,
with know, a late like, and Abel Tasman. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a perfect example. So you know, they allow, that's allowed. It's within the way the rules are interpreted in New York. Now, that might not be that way at any other jurisdiction, but it is the way it is here. And if your understanding of that as a rider, you know you have to ride as far into that line as humanly possible, especially when it's a desperately close race and you're trying to beat a champion who's throwing her best punch at you. I think Jose Lascano rode tremendous. He walked on that tight rope as fine as you possibly could. Now, to me, the Bowling Green was different because it was just so much more dramatic and it was big contact. It wasn't subtle, you know, brushing or rubbing. You know, that wasn't race riding. That was, and I don't, listen, I know Javier Castellano is not going to like me saying this, but I have to call it the way I see it. That was pilot error. I haven't heard anybody say, and maybe I just haven't been paying as close attention because I'm up here being a farmer, but why didn't he go to his left hand? Why was he continually going at him right-handed as he was leaning in on horses? You're blowing by them. I think he made a mistake. I mean, he's a great rider, obviously, Hall of Famer, you know, six Travers, but I don't blame the horse for that one. I blame Javier for that one.
Yeah, and you feel badly, certainly for you know, for Wood Lane and Tom Albertrani, a horse that you know that has to be cleverly ridden under the best circumstances, and also needs pace. And you know, they're off the turn, and at the eighth pole, he looked a winner. You know, yesterday on Loose on the Lead, I brought out the tape from the race in June from that first defense, Rich, with Therapist and Majestic Dunhill. And granted, that was coming and the contact there and you know the way in which the drifting was happening, it was more in the shadow of the wire, and it didn't create a multi-horse chain reaction. So it isn't as dramatic as you aptly put it, but there
I would have
no
taken
change.
That number down too, though.
That's my point. That's my point. Yeah. That if they're going to do this, then you got to do it every time. You can't do it selectively.
Let me explain though, because it was, you know, a very narrow finish. Ray Lou Gutierrez is in the middle on George Weaver's horse. Therapist is outside, starts leaning on him. Ironically enough, it's Irad's brother Jose's on the inside of Ray Lou, and Ray Lou's trying to ride responsibly enough where he doesn't put him in jeopardy. And he's got his horse's head cocked out the Therapist to try to give Jose as much space as humanly possible. Now, we were covering the races. I was at Belmont on the third floor, and because we don't have fans there at the moment, you can hear everything. And I could hear Jose scream about 40 yards from the wire because he got in so tight from the third floor. And Ray Lou's got his horse's head cocked out and gets beat a very short margin. To me, when a rider has to have a horse's head cocked out, it means he's correcting him through no fault of his because he's getting leaned off from the outside. He can't just continually go forward, and you get beat a few inches. That cost him the race. And he's protecting Irad's brother. So, you know, to me, the whole thing was so ironic. That number would have come down if I had anything to say about it as a steward. Now, I know it's a tough, thankless job, but and it was more subtle than the other day. The other day became, you know, bumper cars. But I'm with you. Consistency. I think the personal ensign was a very consistent call. I'm not convinced that if you look at those two incidents, that is as consistent.
Now, that's the issue to me is the consistency. You've got to you can't. As difficult as the job is anyway, you can't invite scrutiny and criticism if you're consistent. If everybody sees it happen and you, for the most part, uniformly agrees that, well, that's going to be a DQ, or no, that one didn't have enough. When there's confusion, that's an issue. That's
the
problem.
Other thing, you know, too, like it gets me, you know, my blood up, is, you know, this thing about, you know, well, it's out of the gate. I'm so tired of hearing this nonsense. These are some of the greatest riders in the world. We have a tremendous jockey colony in New York, incredibly young, talented group of guys. You know, Javier Castellano, Hall of Famer, Johnny Vasquez, Hall of Famer. Then you got all these kids, and Joel Rosario. These guys can do things on horseback that a lot of other people cannot do. And if you allow them to let horses run wherever they want out of the gate, well, of course they're going to do it. Human nature. If I get shut off five times leaving the gate and there's no sanction for it, there's no repercussions, well, the next time my horse breaks left or right, I don't care about you. I'm the guy getting it all the time, so I'm going to, whatever happens, happens, because there's no ramifications.
Right.
You've created this rough riding out of the gate, and they
correct.
Are capable of doing so much more. One out of 20 will get away from a guy and really, you know, just have it on his mind. He's going to go hard left or hard right. But if you know that you have to be responsible leaving the gate, trust me, the starts will be much, much cleaner, because they are capable. And I'm tired of hearing that nonsense that, oh, it was out of the gate. That's malarkey.
Yes, there's a polite word. Rich, got to also get the coverage in. The one race we really haven't spoken much about yet this morning, a couple of quick notations to it, was the Jerkins. And I just made mention from a betting standpoint that I was surprised at how much money essentially was being directed toward No Parole in a set of conditions going the 7/8 that just did not seem, you know, nearly as friendly for him and his prospects as 3/4. And that kind of, you know, was really the scenario. Talk about what you saw and what your take was on the Jerkins.
Yeah, I'm with you about that. I thought that just the way the race seemed to shape up was going to play against No Parole. And I'm sorry, Steve's horse that won, his name's escaping me at the moment.
Echo Town.
Yeah, Echo Town. You know, I thought he ran extremely well the time before at Belmont when No Parole was very loose and gave a really good account of himself and looked like the race was going to shape up much better for him in the Jerkins. And it did, and, you know, kind of played out that way. I was surprised as well. I just thought that, and listen, he ran in the Woody Stevens. I'm not belittling his effort there, but I just thought he was going to face a different kind of circumstance in the Jerkins, which made him vulnerable, and that's how it played out. You know, still a terrific horse, you know, wonderful sprinter, but, you know, when you have those lead types, horses that kind of, you know, need the lead or that's their style, they're always going to be vulnerable to somebody, you know, taking them on early. And it could be a horse that has no chance, you know, cheap speed horse that can engage you for a quarter or 3/8 of a mile. I've always said, you know, when I was riding, if I really wanted to wind one up, I can make Francis the Mule go a quarter and 21 and change. I mean, if I really wanted to. You know, and again, not that they could win, but they can have an impact on how the race is run.
Right. Right. Exactly. And, you know, the horse I keep coming back to, I mean, Echo Town displayed in the Woody Stevens, you know, how viable he was coming back in this spot, and Shoplifted, you knew, was going to, you know, be coming a little bit later. The horse between them that ran a courageous race, even being beaten in the end 3.5 lengths, according to the chart. Tap It to Win was the only horse that attended the pace and was left standing at the end, because Mischievous Alex, 8 rings, No Parole, and Liam's Pride, they ended up 6th, 7th, 9th, and 11th. And meanwhile, Tap It to Win ends up a very good second in here on the turn back.
Well, you know, and it's interesting you say that. Those are the things people need to pay more attention of. It's something Andy Serling always talks about. You know, when a horse you know, is the one in the teeth of that, and everybody else well beaten, and they're still hanging around, it really elevates, it upgrades their effort. And you know, he's shown his brilliance. He seems to me like that perfect miler type. You know, he's 7'8", he's always going to be a bit sharp, and he's fast enough to be in it. But a mile, like, you know, well, the mile in the 16th at Belmont that he ran was, you know, dominant. But I think like a perfect one turn mile, like he's next year's early future book for the Met Mile. How's that?
There you go. We'll see. Also, you know, these horses go in a lot of different directions. You know, some will go back to three quarters. There's some that you know will stay on. There are some that'll point for things like the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. You know, there's all different avenues of for these to take. There's a couple that have got a little bit of turf aptitude that might get tested further, etc. As always, it's a race that never disappoints, Rich.
No, it doesn't, and you know, it should be that kind of race named for Alan Jerkins. You know, what can you say? He was New York racing. He represented the heart and soul of New York racing, and you think about all the horsemen that would go to him when they couldn't figure something out or you know, had an issue with a horse and just wasn't quite sure. And he was always so generous with his time, and he was always about the horses. And, you know, I was thinking about it the other night, just missed being able to go to his barn after, you know, getting done riding and push the feed cart and listen to him talk about horses. And, you know, wonderful, wonderful memories. And, you know, I'm glad that they renamed that race for him, because it's so deserving.
And of course, you were very valuable to the football games, to Chiefs football games, right? You were.
Yeah, we had some fun. We had a lot of fun, the touch football games, and the Chief would be the designated quarterback, so he'd be the quarterback for both sides. And I remember we were playing up in the quarter post through the training track one winter, and it had snowed a lot that winter, and there was these big snow walls that, you know, they shoveled the snow off. And I kept beating one of his grooms. The guy was pretty big, and the guy was getting frustrated. And Alan knew I had to step on him. And probably about the third or fourth time I scored on him, the next time I went to catch the ball, this guy, you know, we were playing touch. He drilled me into one of the snowbanks. I mean, he just leveled me. And Alan went nuts. He's, the guy's got to make a living with his body. He already broke his neck once. You want him to break his neck again playing this game? Oh, he was so mad.
Love it. That's great. Rich,
yeah,
a couple of memories. No, undoubtedly. And Chuck Simon wrote a beautiful piece, too. I don't know if you saw Chuck's piece.
I saw that.
Yeah, really
saw that.
Nice.
That was really, Chuck, that was like right to my heart.
Yeah, I'll send a link to that, too. And a couple of other notes, Rich, from the weekend. And got to mention the two-year-old that opened the action, you know, that two-year-old race on Whitney Day. In fact, Dave Grenig talked about it on Friday coming into the weekend. You know, very often a showcase for top performance and for top prospects, and reinvestment risk did not disappoint. The upstart two-year-old for Chad and for Seth Klarman and Rad Ortiz aboard, and backers got $10, one off by himself.
You know, we've seen two-year-olds debut and be impressive and win by open lengths. But what differentiates this kind of performance to me is the professionalism he showed. Sitting in behind horses, I'd ask people, go back and watch the replay. You see two-year-olds climb from the kickback when they're in behind horses or be tentative. And, you know, they're facing a situation they've never faced before. You can school horses in the morning behind other horses, but that's a very controlled environment. The kickback doesn't come back as hard because you're not going, you know, 22, you're going 24. So it just stands to reason the kickback's not coming back with that same intensity or ferocity. And he just was as comfortable and traveling smoothly as a horse could be. And I picked him up early and go, man, look at the way this two-year-old's handling everything and galloping up and behind him. And then, you know, he had room inside, but again, no hesitation, no apprehension, slid up in the spot in hand, was asked. And then the last 16th of a mile, you know, he's doing it easily, but his stride never deteriorated. We look at horses sometimes win by open lengths, but their stride's deteriorating. It's just everybody behind them is as well. His legs were underneath him, which leads you to believe, I mean, you know, we'll see as we go forward, that there's a lot left when a horse still has their legs underneath and their form doesn't deteriorate. Very exciting, but his professionalism is what got me in. You know, think about Tizzalore last year. His professionalism in his debut was very similar. Very, very similar. That, you know, young horses that have the physical attributes but then have the mind to back it up, those are the ones that are the real deal.
Well, wins off by widening length, 7+, and Windcracker, Amos, and Amos is having a nice meet. He did have the upset winner 17-1 in the next race, King Cause, but Windcracker came back and one of two horses with experience in the race and runs a good second. That horse is going to win soon. King Cause then, as I mentioned, $36 winner. The day was rolling early. The only thing missing, Rich, before we wrap up, the only thing missing was, a group of 36, 37,000. That's what we would have had on Saturday on a beautiful day, and that's always seemingly the bittersweet part of, of what we're seeing so far at the meet.
It is. It really is. And my heart goes out to the fans and the people that, you know, look forward to and anticipate, you know, particularly Saratoga every year. My fervent wish is that, you know, they're following along with us on, Saratoga Live, and hopefully we're conveying the enthusiasm, the excitement level, even though, you know, they can't be there, that hopefully that, you know, it's some small consolation. It's very eerie when you're on the trackside set and the horses run by you, because all you hear is, you know, the riders and the hoofbeats. Where normally you hear a crowd. It's less so on the paddock set because they've got that area set up where,
right,
you know, a certain amount of owners can be there. There's activity in the paddock, and you don't feel the impact of it as much. But when you're out on the front side, you really feel it. And, listen, it's the hand that the world has been dealt this year, and, you know, everybody trying to do the best they can and stay healthy and help each other. And, I look forward to hopefully next year everything's sorted out and it'll be an even bigger celebration because we'll all have missed that so much.
Exactly. Well put. Rich Migliore, we will see you midweek, back Wednesday?
Yeah, back Wednesday, Thursday, and I believe one of the weekend days. I'm not sure yet, but definitely Wednesday, Thursday. And, been enjoying it. Got just a tremendous crew. Obviously, everybody sees everybody in front of the camera, and I love the talent, you know, the on-air talent that I get to work with. But people that are doing all the work in the trucks, I'm always a bit apprehensive to just start naming names because I don't want to leave anybody out. But we have an incredible crew of people that make what we do on the other side of the camera seem very seamless, and their work they put in is way beyond what we do in front of the camera.
Rich Migliore, everybody. Follow Mig on Twitter. Richard Migliore. He could have gone with Mig. He could have gone with the Mig.
Yeah, somebody had the Mig.
Somebody had the Mig? Get out of here.
That's not right. Scott Hazelton is the one who helped set up my Twitter, you know, several years ago. And he's like, I will put at the Mig. And then he goes, oh, it's taken. And then, you know, a bunch of different variations of the Mig was taken, and he's like, well, how about the Mig TV? And I was like, just put out Richard Migliore. But
that's fine, and we know who you are, Rich Migliore, everybody, and the tremendous work going on daily, five shows a week from first race through the nightcap. And it was a long day Saturday, but well worth it. Rich, I'll see you this week.
Look forward to it, Steve. Thanks.
Rich Migliore. We're going to stay right here. Standing by is Mark Glatt. And you heard what it was like to be second in the Bing Crosby. Now you're going to hear what it's like to be first and third in the Bing Crosby, because for Mark, a 1-3 finish in the grade one, and Collusion Illusion, who just keeps clicking along. And this was a big task and a big assignment, and he comes through, came through as the favorite. He got bet as well. Mark Glatt joins us. Mark, always a delight when we can call you and congratulate you on a win like this.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning, and out to Del Mar and the Bing Crosby on the front end of the meet, the Pat O'Brien later, you know, two of the great summer standards for sprinters. Talk about Collusion Illusion's development. This is a great win for him.
Yes, thank you. He ran a very nice race. We were pretty confident going in, but it was older horses, and it was not an easy race. We thought we would get a perfect duel in front of him, and we got that perfect duel. I think what made the race most impressive was he's been a little bit to the not liking of dirt kicked in his face, and given how the race set up with, you know, a wall of horses in front of him to save any ground, he had to take dirt, and he took quite a bit of it, and he ran into it and finished extremely well. So that was a good test that he passed, that he hadn't really had that experience, or when he'd gotten a little dirt in the past, it hadn't been favorable for him. So we were excited to see that he showed a little bit of a different dimension with getting dirt kicked in his face.
Well, and you had to be initially certainly off the draw, having him a little bit outside. If you got a horse that you have that concern, having him outside, at least, you know, you think you might be able to work out a trip before the turn and you know, ease him into a spot that might be advantageous. Flavian Pratt at this point has been on with him for, you know, only one of his wins. Joe Talamo had him in the Best Pal, but otherwise Flavian kind of knows, you know, what kind of reaction he's going to get. Fold in Mark facing Elders at you know, it's not too early in the season, and obviously it's a unique year, but there are still plenty of 3-year-old restricted opportunities. In fact, of course, we ran the Jerkins. We just talked to about it minutes ago. But facing Elders at this point, just nothing else really, or you just assumed he was going to be up to it?
Well, it was actually a very tough decision. We were very close to shipping out for the Jerkins, and there were a couple of factors that ended up swaying me to staying home and running against Elders. And given the COVID-19 thing, it's kind of difficult to send a horse with personnel out of town to run, and so we had the ability to enter into the Bing Crosby on Sunday. The horse wouldn't have gotten on a he would not have gotten on a plane until Tuesday, and when we entered on Sunday for Saturday in the Bing Crosby, and I seen he drew the 9 hole. You know, I just felt like that was too favorable. That's what ultimately swayed me was him drawing the outside post, not knowing what he might draw in the Jerkins, and not knowing exactly how all the shipping arrangements would go for him specifically. And I wasn't able to take Flavian Pratt, of course, who's, I think, undefeated on the horse out of 3 or 4 starts now. And also, he was 2-for-2 here last summer at Del Mar on this Del Mar main track. So all of those things, you know, kind of ended up ultimately, you know, made our decision for us. But the final kicker was drawn the outside post here. You know, if I had to put him on a plane and he's drawn inside in the Jerkins in what would have then been a 12-horse field, you know, who knows? So we kind of gambled the right way, and it's worked out.
And, you know, of course, the funny thing about this was your decision making essentially was the same template that that Jack Sisterson talked about with us an hour ago when he had to do the opposite, when Lexingtonian had to come out at, you know, a gate scratch from the Vanderbilt last week. And now, you know, Jack's got to jump through hoops to get him out to Del Mar, which, you know, is a considerable ship.
Right. Yeah, I'd heard that whole story, and you know, he drew the one hole here, of course, and
yeah, exactly.
I don't think that probably helped his chances. I mean, you know, these decisions that we have to make sometimes are crucial, and sometimes you don't know whether to zig or zag, you know, because you know that maybe the couple of choices in front of you are so close, but ultimately you just hope that most of the time you do make the right decision.
Mark, you also, you talked about him, you know, being comfortable at Del Mar and, you know, being able to train over the track, having won last summer. He broke his maiden there and then pretty much romped as well in the Best Pal. And we talked about him, you know, last summer plenty. The comments from John Sheriffs, and Baffert discussed this too over the last few weeks, and of course earlier on the card they ran that shared belief, and Sheriffs had said, you know, that the track had changed really from earlier in the summer, and it's very obvious, and you know, last week when everybody, you know, was watching the San Diego, how heavy and dull the surface appears. What's your take on you know, what's gone on with that main track?
Well, you're right. When we first got down here this summer, the track was extremely slow. And, you know, you're kind of in a position with these horses, if they like it enough, you're okay. But a lot of horses don't like it. And I think we've tried to put some pressure on management to get, you know, some more water on the track and get it tightened up. And, you know, I think management's theory on this whole thing is, you know, the slower the better. Yeah. And potentially the slower they run, maybe the more safe it is, you know, from, you know, getting catastrophic injuries. And they have had a, knock on wood, a very successful meet in that regard. But I think there's a happy median, you know, when fields are strung out, you know, 20, 30 lengths, you know, when Maximum Security, who is arguably the best horse in the world, runs 144 and change in the San Diego, you know, it opens your eyes a little bit in what's really going on here. So, you know, they got the racetrack tightened up here, it appeared this week. The rail was, you know, if you drew the inside here the first couple few weeks of the meet,
forget
you know,
it.
You might as well, you know, you're already beat basically. But Collusion ended up coming up the rail, as it turns out, and so I think they've got it, you know, figured out where it's, you know, maybe a little bit quicker, a little bit more water in it, you know, and that just kind of started here this week. So it's you know, it's a challenge because you know, I'm a big fan of Honor AP, and, you know, I didn't think maybe he did like the surface that much, watching him, honestly. But that's what we're up against here, and we understand, I think, you know, why it is the way it is. But hopefully they're getting closer to that happy medium that, you know, that horses, you know, it's fair to all, you know, more fair to all horses, and yet continues to be safe.
Well, this performance provides a third graded stake win now for Collusion Illusion, the Twirling Candy colt out of Natalie Grace, Mr. Disney, originally bred, and $300,000 as an OBS purchase last year. And for the connection... for the connections involved here, some familiar names, but not sure if how many, you know, how many grade ones among that ownership group.
Well, I know that was my first grade one, and I think for most of the owners, it was, you know, their first grade one win, and it was you know, very, very exciting to accomplish that and accomplish it with a horse that I purchased for them. And hopefully that's not the last one.
Well, and I didn't realize, as much as we've spoken, I didn't realize that this was your first grade one as well. And what, you know, Jack Sisterson, it's good because it's good that Jack lost that photograph because he had already gotten a grade one earlier in the day. So you both got your first grade ones.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they, unfortunately, they just don't hand those grade ones out very easily. And, you know, been close, you know, in a lot of them over the years, you know, won several grade twos and grade threes, but just never been able to capture that grade one win. So that was very nice. And, you know, and I got to say, my other horse in the race,
yes,
Biden Citizen, I got to give him a heck of a lot of credit. He helped set up the pace a little bit. That wasn't really the idea going into the race. It just kind of turned out that way. Where Abel Cedillo had him a little bit closer than I wanted him to be. But he dueled through, you know, 44 and change here on this track, even though it was tighter this week. And to be anywhere near, you know, at the end was a remarkable performance. That horse, he's always been extremely hard trying. When he's right, he's going to give you everything he's got, and he gave it to us on Saturday. And although he's a gelding, I think it's quite an accomplishment for him to be grade one placed now. He's won a couple of grade threes, and you know he might catch one of these kind of races along the way here where he'll be in the winner's circle, but. You know, he really ran a heck of a race, and really just as proud of him as we were with Collusion Illusion.
Well, of course, he's a brother of Feedback, and this is all Hill and Dale. Honest Answer, The Tale of the Catmare, and a Twirling Candy gelding, now well over $500,000 in earnings, and he's been a consistent hard hitter, multiple graded stake placed coming in, and a grade three winner. And he does, you know, what's interesting about him, Mark, is that he's done a little bit of everything. And I'm curious how much of what you've been doing with him is a result of not being able to run him down the hill course and, you know, putting him on the main track and sprinting him, you know, three quarters and such, on dirt.
Well, a little bit of it with him has been race availability, and I still say, as good as his recent form is on the dirt, I still think he's at his very best running down the hillside course.
Yeah, yeah.
And he actually won the grade three in the very last great hillside course we've seen run to this point. You know, he gets a flat mile, but he really doesn't want, you know, a heck of a lot further than that. And, you know, at the end of the day, I haven't ventured this way yet, but I'd love to see that horse run maybe a one turn mile on the grass or seven furlong, something along those lines where I think
sure.
He would, you know, really excel. But he's a 6-year old now. He's, you know, some horses, you know, get better with age. And I think it's fair to say that he has, and we gave him a nice break after he won the Long Acres Mile, and really he's come back to be better than ever. And when horses get that good and that sharp, as long as you're somewhere within the limits of what they, you know, want to do, they can do quite well. And you know, he's just, like I mentioned earlier, he's such a gritty, hard trying horse that he might run on rocks if we let him. You know, because he's just about as hard a trying horse as I've ever trained.
Well, you know what, you should really consider the Woodbine Mile.
Yeah, there are some options out there, certainly some options to look at, you know, here into the future. And that race every year is extremely tough, it seems. But I think off of his his current form this year and certainly his performance the other day that we've always kind of felt like he was just a notch below, you know, if we got him, of the best horses, particularly here in Southern California. But, he may be able to venture off now into something like the Woodbine Mile and we'll have to take a shot with it. But we'll see. He ran awfully hard the other day. We'll see how he bounces back here when he gets back on the racetrack, and then we'll figure out a plan for him.
Well, I can just think back, in fact, to last, was it? Yeah, it was last fall, and you had the huge upset winner, who I think was an older gelding himself last year, that of Gail Cox's and Sam's sons, El Tormenta. Was an enormous, I want to say, I don't know, 20-30 to 1. So, and very similar, I think, kind of a career. So you fit, absolutely fit with Law Abiding Citizen. And Collusion Illusion, of course, gets to, I suppose, the trip to, you know, to Keeneland. How do you plan that? Do you Pat O'Brien, and or do you want to do something else, which could include, even we talked to Jack, you could meet Lexingtonian again in the Phoenix and prep right on the Breeders' Cup surface.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see how the horse comes back here and everything. I'm inclined to probably just run him once more before the Breeders' Cup, and ideally that would be about a month out from the Breeders' Cup race. So he probably won't run here for, 6 to 8 weeks. We'll look at the Phoenix, I'm sure. I think they'll have a sprint, prep at Santa Anita as well. We'll see how he kind of bounces back here and come up ultimately with a plan that hopefully gets us there in early November.
Outstanding. Mark Glatt with us, and we're talking about Collusion Illusion, who has now taken down 3 graded stakes and a grade 1 winner. He's a twirling candy colt, and certainly, he's seemingly on his way to a stud deal somewhere, you would think, Mark, given how successful and consistent Twirling Candy has become as a sire. And could see, frankly, just speculating, you could probably see him returning to Florida, actually. That would right now, depending on what else is down the road, and there's a lot of opportunity yet down the road for this 3-year-old colt. Talk a little bit more too about the summer overall, Mark, and we're starting to edge closer to the halfway point at Saratoga and at Del Mar. You had the 1 weekend hiccup. Looks like those issues are behind everybody.
Yeah, hopefully, and we actually this week were able to open up the racing in the afternoon to owners on a limited basis, but it's been nice to get owners out here and actually have some people at the races. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to continue to trend that way, where we can gradually let more and more people, owners who are essential to the business, in to watch these races and get back to having fans. It's been a bit surreal here at Del Mar, where there's usually anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000 people here on a Saturday afternoon to there actually being zero, or just the ones here that are running these horses. So it's been a unique experience. I'm just glad we're continuing to be racing. And hopefully, like I said, by the time we get to the end of the year, I mean, I think about, potentially having a Breeders' Cup horse, and will there be fans or won't there be fans? Mm. So I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen in November yet, but we'll have to wait and see on that. But yeah, it's been, I've gotten off to an okay start here. We've won a couple of stakes, and we're just looking to hopefully, finish out the remainder of the meet in good form here and see what happens this fall.
How are you looking on your 2-year-old front? I know you got a state bred coming up next Saturday.
Yeah, we're okay. I acquired the majority of the 2-year-olds that I have this year. I acquired in the sales, and the sales were postponed. So sure. I think it's fair to say I'm a little bit behind in having 2-year-olds ready to run. There'll be more like fall horses. I bought, 3 or 4 out of the OBS June sale and then a couple out of the Maryland sale. I was fortunate enough to pick up a flatter colt out of the Maryland sale, and he cost $600,000. We're extremely, extremely impressed with the horse here to this point, but because we kind of got him so late in the summer here or late in the sales due to the postponement of them. Normally he'd been a horse we might have bought in May. The Maryland sale was supposed to be in May. He might have been ready to run here at this Del Mar meet, but it looks like he's coming along, and he's coming along quickly, and looking to see hopefully getting him to the races at Santa Anita this fall.
What's his name?
His name is Affable.
Oh, great name.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
And, great name.
For a new owner into the business, and, he's jumped in here, bought a couple of 2-year-olds here, and he's excited about the business. He's followed the game for a long time and has decided to jump in, and he jumped in pretty strongly, I might say, to step up for a colt, for that kind of money. It's pretty strong, and we'll just hope that it works out for him and he has a good experience and that he's successful.
Really nice. And Florida bred out of the Wildcat Air Mare, Wild About Shopping, and pretty cool. This was one of Kerry Frommer's.
Yes, he breezed. We really liked his breeze. He's a beautiful horse, and really, until you actually get your hands on him, his disposition is just incredible. He's all business out on the racetrack, but when he comes back and comes back into his stall after he trains, he might be sacked out and sleeping for 22 out of the 24 hours a day. He knows how to take care of himself, and he's just been a true professional here from the get-go. And he's breezed a couple times here at Del Mar. He'll probably breeze 3 furlongs here this coming Friday, and he's in a very interesting horse, and hopefully a horse that pans out like we think he might.
Nice job. Those qualities you mentioned, obviously, the horse's makeup starts the whole process, but, that's a tribute to Kerry Frommer and the job she does as well. And you get a horse that isn't bothered by anything and gets to a new environment and, knows to sleep and is comfortable and lays down. And that's a big part of it. That's like one headache that, you just don't know until you get them home and you watch them a few days and see how they act. This is out of a very strong female family, which obviously contributed to that price tag. Wild About Shopping, the Wildcat Air Mare, a sister of Trap Shot, Shop Again, Miss Shop, a pretty strong set of siblings to this one. And this is exciting. And obviously his disposition contributed to the choice of his name. This is a story in the making, Mark, I can tell.
Well, we hope so. That's, as you mentioned there, we can see their athletic ability. We can look at a catalog page and we can, see what kind of pedigree they have. But and really, because you're only viewing them, for a short period of time before you actually pull the trigger and buy one, you really don't know, if the heart and desire there, the willingness, and are they going to kind of fall apart under pressure. All of those things are important components to what makes a good racehorse or a great racehorse. And to this point, We just couldn't be happier with how he acts. He's just kind of got that aura about him that, mm-hmm. that you want to see. And certainly, like I said, looks like he has all the tools physically to become a good horse. So we're excited. Wish he was ready to run, but we got
That's
a little
right.
work ahead of us here, and we'll see what happens here this fall with him.
Affable, everybody. Affable, a flatter colt, and in good hands with Mark. I'll tell a quick story before we go that helped teach me about this part of a horse's makeup. At the Derby, this would have been what 2000, and I'm going to lose track of what year it was. The story is about Summerbird. And, at Churchill, when they put a lot of the Derby horses in barn 42 and 43, and it's usually a pretty, it's a busy spot, and, it faces up against Longfield and there's traffic, and then there's all kinds of, people come, and, it's kind of mayhem. There'll be 8, 9, 10 horses, typically 5 or 6 on each side. And, maybe that's 7 or 8 outfits that are involved. So it's always bustling. I went to see Tim Ice, Mark, and Summerbird had done his work early in the morning. And so now it's like, 9 o'clock, baby, 9:30. And so there's horses, going and coming, and there's horses that are cooling out, and they're tacked up, and they're walking. And he was in the last stall on the corner. And Tim goes to take me to show him, and he's laying down, and he's not just laying down. He's got his head sticking out under the webbing as he's laying down, and he's watching the horses go by.
Yeah.
And I said to Tim, I said, you got to be kidding me. He said, no. He said, nothing bothers him. He takes everything in stride. But I'd never seen that. I've seen them, with their head close to the opening, but his head was directly underneath the webbing, and he's just kind of smiling, watching horses go by. I kind of, in the back of my mind, I said, well, this is obviously a horse that, the kind that has the makeup. And, later on, all he did was win a Belmont Stake, a Travers, and a Jockey Club Gold Cup.
Right. Well, and as I mentioned earlier, these horses that compete at the highest levels, a lot of them are in the ones that don't. There's maybe not a terrible amount of, athletic ability,
right.
or a difference in their athletic
yep.
ability. It's the ones that obviously have to have, ability, but it's the ones that can handle pressure and, keep in good weight once they're introduced to the pressure of racing. Those are the ones that surface to the top of the game. And so that's really what you're looking for early on with a young horse is, what kind of mental makeup do they have? And if you get that and they have some ability to go along with it, you got to have both to have a good one. It's frustrating when you have, and it works the opposite too. You have horses that don't maybe have the most ability in the world, but they're just, the most trying horses and just really competitive. And, them horses end up grinding out good solid careers, but when you get both, that's when you're in business. So we'll see.
Give us a quick look-see about the Calbred coming up next week. Susie Q's brother. This is a commissioner gelding from Mark Cohen, a homebred.
Yeah, he's been very solid so far in his morning workouts. Pretty good natured. He's actually a gelding now, but he's a pretty good-natured horse, seems very willing, and seems to get over this Del Mar surface okay. So he drew a good post, and, we're hopeful that he, has a good, strong effort, something we can build off of, and maybe a colt or gelding that wants to go a little further down the road, but he's ready to go, and we're going to get a start under his belt and kind of see where he can take us from there.
Outstanding. Susie Q's brother in the eighth race on Saturday at Del Mar. Mark, always happy when you get a big one, and this is certainly pretty momentous. Your first grade one, pretty good pair of horsemen between Jack Sisterson and Mark Glatt, both getting big grade one victories, first of their respective careers. And you must know Jack a long time too from his days with Doug.
Yeah, I didn't really get to know him very well. But congratulations to him this weekend, and I'm glad he didn't get two grade ones.
Exactly.
But congrats to him, and we'll maybe meet up again.
That seems like it's in the cards. Gosh, just thrilled, Mark, for you to get this, and always look forward when I watch the race. And I said, "Good, I get to talk to Glatt on Monday." Mark, what continued success?
I sure appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Not at all, Mark Glatt. Everybody who you can't rave about enough as a horseman and as a backstretch leader, and Hammer has told you, a guy that the racing offices management consults with, just held in the highest regard. Mark Glatt, unbelievable. I didn't realize that was his first grade one. Amazing. Let's take a break, our last of the morning, second of the morning, and we still got tons to do. We got LP3, Lafitte Pinkai III, and more. We may have to make a decision between Bob Baffert and Ferran Peterson. Of course, Ferran, let's see, Baffert won, did he win four stakes? She won four races. Baffert, I think, won 4-2, because I think he won a maiden race, too, right, on Saturday? We'll take the break. Oh, Tina wants to leave for Rochester, so I have to break now no matter what. Talk after this. Lafitte Pinkai III.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Ah, Saratoga. It's history. It's tradition. It's world-class racing. It's jump racing. Yes, steeplechase racing has played a role in Saratoga's rich history and tradition since 1864. And today, it's a part of what makes Saratoga so special. Watch every Wednesday of the meet and two special Thursdays featuring the Grade 1 AP Smithick on July 23rd and the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup on August 20th. Savor the thrill of horses flying over fences. Steeplechase racing, it's a Saratoga tradition.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on? University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Pletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation.